Some of these programs are pretty controversial. You know, as we go along talking tonight with Dr. Timbal, I'm thinking as the government encroaches upon us more and more, privacy is less and less, we're being squeezed more and more by expense and taxes. We'll complain, and then eventually we'll resist. But the question, why the need for all this surveillance in our homes, on our phones, drones in the sky, talk shows, this one being monitored to hear what we may be saying, resistant to the global takeover? And we're talking about climate change tonight, but there are scientists among you out there. There are intelligent leaders waiting to lead out there, waiting for your voice to be heard. We are, all of us, waiting for your voice. What is it Spock said to his duplicate? Every revolution begins with one voice. Why not yours? What will happen when we resist? The food, the fuel, everything increasing in expense. What will happen when we resist? We'll be back for our final hour with Dr. Tim Ball, a rational man, climatologist, and a solid thinker. Stand by. 2 minutes. Coast to Coast AM will return. John B. Weldon with you tonight, talking with Dr. Tim Ball. You know, Doctor, I want you to carry on with what you were saying about all these artifacts that began showing up when it was time for China to do some buying. But you know, as I sit here, I'll tell you the truth. I was trying to just thank everybody for becoming a Coast Insider, and I could barely get it out because it's one thing to talk about this stuff, but when I really start into this and it becomes a rich conversation rather than an interview, I start getting mad and a little bit upset and slightly inarticulate because this whole thing is just making me nuts because it's right out there in front of everybody what's going on, and yet the ship just keeps sailing in the same direction. So comment on that as you will and just carry on with where you were because you're very interesting and I want to hear everything you have to say.
Well, thank you. Yes, and of course that, as I said, that's what they rely on is the ship will keep going on in the same direction. And one of the interesting, and I'll get back to the wheat thing in China in just a second, but one of the interesting statistics is that the only German prisoner of war that ever escaped was a guy got out of a logging camp in Canada and got down to South America. No German prisoner ever escaped in Britain, but hundreds of them escaped in Germany. And I think the difference was that a lot of the German people were opposed to Hitler and what he was doing. And whereas in England, the whole country was behind what was going on. And I think that's a very telling sort of thing. But the point I was making about with China was that they knew, as I said, the Canadian Wheat Board knew when China were going to buy some wheat from Canada because these precious objects showed up, and they paid cash for their wheat. And they told me that what was going on was China was buying wheat from Canada around $2 to $3 a bushel at that time, but they were then making their own people eat the wheat and taking their rice and selling their rice that they were growing into Southeast Asia and other markets for $3 and $4 a bushel. In other words, they were turning a profit on the deal. And so what you have going on in China is really what I call state capitalism. And of course, as you know, anybody that tries to do business in even in Russia today, ultimately the state will step in when they don't like what's going on and control what's happening. And of course, China is exactly the same way. And of course, by the way, I've worked with both Russian and Chinese climatologists over reconstruction of past weather. And they have a very different view of the world than North America or even Western Europe, and it's something I think that we make a big mistake. We say, well, we're dealing with the Chinese, not realizing the Chinese see the world completely differently. Basically, they see everything on the planet is there for the betterment and advancement of humans. And if you don't believe me, just go to a Chinese food market, and everything that crawls, wriggles, is for sale to eat. End of story. And of course, you see them building two coal burning plants a week right now, and nuclear plants they're putting up all over the place. So, you know, what's the point of unilateral, even if CO2 was a problem, but when it isn't? So, yeah, this idea about state capitalism, of course, then you can expand to the world in terms of the world government. And one of the things that they were discussing at Copenhagen that I mentioned earlier, the Conference of the Parties at Copenhagen, which was sidelined by the leaked emails, but the discussion there was about setting the taxation of carbon through the International Monetary Fund, and it was all going to be this centralized banking idea, which of course is how you establish a world government. It's the way they did it with the unifying of the money in Europe, with the euro coming into being. So as I said, how do you compete with state capitalism? I'm not sure.
State capitalism, that's the perfect combination of communism and capitalism, isn't it? That's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. We of course, you know, governments basically run Ponzi schemes, except that they can, as the American governments and the British government are doing, you can keep the Ponzi scheme going because you can just print more money. You know, with a Ponzi scheme run by somebody in Wall Street, they run into problems the minute somebody says, "Hey, I want my money back." Now they've got a problem. But if we went to the government and say, "Hey, we want our money back," they just print more money and give it to you, and of course they can perpetuate the Ponzi scheme. And but yeah, state capitalism, state running of everything, and it's really the debate of the post-war debate. I've written about this in an article on my website. But during the war, we surrendered most of our rights, individual rights, to the government in the war effort. Certainly, I was born in England and living in England at the time. I mean, you even had your clothing rationed. The government decided how many coats you could buy and everything else. And in fact, a lot of that rationing went on up into the 1950s. But what happened after the war was that government were loath to give back all of that power that they had. And of course, then since then, the government's grown and grown. And what we're at the point now is we're starting to say, well, maybe government's not the best running everything, but we've got generations who've never known anything different.
Well, and it's amazing, too. Can anybody point out a poor politician, anybody who's been in office for very long, are any of these people at, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year? I don't think so.
Well, of course, John, one of the things, and I worked with a Canadian author on a book on the Hudson Bay Company, which, of course, is the most successful multinational corporation in history. But he said to me one day, there's only two kinds of politicians. There are those that say, I've got some ideas that I think can help the country. And then there are those that say, I've got some ideas that I think can help myself. And he said, they're both always there. It's that all that changes is the percentage of them. But now in today's society, where it's, you know, the me, the narcissistic society, you've got a preponderance of those that are there to help themselves. And any of those that dare to say, hey, maybe we should do this for the country, are seen by the rest of them as fools and get silenced very quickly.
And you know, the father of advertising, I saw this about 5 o'clock in the morning one time, and it was about the father of advertising. I don't want to say which advertising agency it was, but it was one of the initials in a four-initialed agency. And he said something to the effect of, if you want that new house, buy it. If you want a new car, buy it. If your wife wants a mink stole, get it for her. Get yourself so hopelessly in debt that you can't believe it, because you will realize levels of productivity in yourself that you never dreamed were even possible. And look where it's brought us.
Yep.
That's the whole mentality.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the advertising agents, the advertising industry, you know, bless them, each and every one. They've hired me to do a lot of jobs before, so I'm probably shooting myself in both feet in another unmentionable part as well by saying something like this. But what we used to make jokes When I would do some of these little liners for radio stations, contributing to the decline of Western civilization, here we are, rock whatever. Well, the thing about it is that we were joking, we thought, but we actually were contributing to the decline of Western civilization. And advertising, in general, while it's a beautiful thing, it has convinced everybody that they need to one up the next guy, hence the expression keeping up with the Joneses. And now it's snowballed into this huge thing where nobody is real. I mean, the guy's handing you the keys to your new car and says, come back next year, because wait till you see what I got for you next year. That's going to make this new car you just bought, that you just dropped 20 grand the moment that it rolls out of the parking lot, it's going to make it look like a Model T compared to what we got coming. But thanks very much for your business. I mean, what kind of mentality is this?
Yeah, well, and of course, a couple of points about that. The other, by the way, is the PR, public relations. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about this whole climate issue is that the people at East Anglia, they got the police in first, but they also hired a PR guy to deal with the issue for them. And the guy that they hired had been involved in the hacking of cell phones for stories for the News of the World.
No, is that all?
Oh, yeah. And of course, I see the pattern of PR in the pushback because they now realize they're losing the climate change battle. And I see the pattern of PR. I mean, the phrases that are common to all of these people that are doing it, such as the debate is over. Well, of course, that's the same thing as saying science is settled. And they even talk about in one of the leaked emails, because the way that they controlled things was they controlled the peer review process, and then they put down other people and say, well, how many peer review papers has he got? Oh, he hasn't got very many. And they could do that because they knew it was they were controlling it. But even in one of the leaked emails, they said, you know, we better be careful. This peer review thing might come back and bite us. And, of course, it is, and as it should. But the PR spin on everything now, even the science, and one of the things that now it is about information, John, because one of the things that's been going on is, and I noticed it, whether it's Fox News or any of them, they don't have the weather anymore. They have extreme weather.
Right.
Everything's hyperbole everywhere. And they say, well, there's a hurricane. It's no, hurricane's normal. You know, if you live in a hurricane zone, you're going to have hurricanes. Hello? But it's everything's extreme. And people say, well, the weather's more severe than ever. No, it isn't. It's just that you're hearing about it more. It's just like in the old, you know, if you're introduced to somebody or you hear about somebody, and it seems like every time you turn around, there they are. They were always there. They were just not part of your world. And so now climate and all these stories and part of the PR campaign that's going on is there's a steady stream of articles coming out saying, oh, well, you know, it was the warmest year ever, and there's more storms, there's more this. But when you start to break them down, and I just did one recently on my website, an article that came out, and I just said, okay, here's how you break it down. Here's what they're actually saying. You interpret it for people, and then they realize that there's really nothing to the story except that it's being used to push a political or a particular agenda. And of course, that's part of the difficulty. I mean, the internet is great. It democratizes information, but you've got to know how to read it. You've got to be able to read it with discrimination. You've got to know what they're actually saying. And so that's the real challenge. And of course, it's made even more difficult when these masters of the spin are involving themselves in science and other areas that really should be outside of politics altogether.
Do you think that this initiative that's been undertaken, do you think it's this global warming thing, do you agree that it's losing steam, or do you think that it'll just be ratcheted up a notch? And I mean, you've done modeling and trend tracking on all kinds of things, it appears.
Yeah.
Is there a logical next step in the evolution of this global governance process, or has this particular leg run its course, and now they're going to shift into some other technique?
Well, of course, what's going on now is that, as I said, the public generally obviously there are still a percentage that you know, have trouble with it and buy into it. And you know, they'll throw things at you like, you know, well, what about sea level rise and all of this stuff? And oh, what about the Arctic ice melting and the polar bears? And when you explain what's actually going on there, the fact that every single summer an area the size of the continental U.S. melts every single summer, an area half the size of the state of Illinois melts every single day, and that's normal, then they start to see how they're being duped. And the public don't necessarily fully understand something, but they understand when there's a snow job going on. And I mean, maybe an inappropriate phrase, but they sense that. What's keeping it going right now are those scientists who, of course, have made a career out of it, the environmentalists who, of course, are losing it as an opportunity. But as I said earlier in the program, they're shifting towards water as the great next threat. And, of course, water with the moral component of that will be huge. And we should maybe do a whole program on water one night. But the other thing is that the politicians are still hanging on to it because they don't understand the science, but they also see the tax potential and, the potential. Because the only thing that politicians do with 100% efficiency is find new ways to tax you. It's like with corporations, you know, the service can get worse and worse, but the billing's always right on time. So I always tell them, right, put the people working in the billing department over in the service department and get things going again. But I think that once the politicians realize that the public are simply not buying this anymore, I know it's going on in Canada. The government's cut a lot of the funding to Environment Canada, shifting the focus. And so I think it's losing its momentum. But as I said, what you've got to be prepared for is that push for more and more government, it will still be there, but they'll find another vehicle. And I happen to think it's water.
Water. Well, it's already more expensive than gasoline.
Well, yes. Yeah, and in fact, there was a documentary made several years ago about water more precious than oil. And there was a conference in Milwaukee in the 1990s where Oppenheimer, the investment company, had a meeting for people with $1 billion or more to invest. I knew about it because a former student of mine was handling a $2 billion portfolio, and he was invited. And he said, who was sitting at the table but Coca-Cola and buying up water rights around? And later on, they brought out their Dasani brand of water and bottled water and so on. And of course, there's been several conferences in New York and Boston on water. And if you had a portfolio of stocks just related to water, either purification or delivery or whatever, you'd have done extremely well. In fact, I understand you'd have done better than any other set of portfolios you could have had.
But, yeah, I sure wish I'd bought Microsoft back in the 80s, don't you? We will continue our discussion for the final half hour with Dr. Tim Ball. I like him. And a lot, according to my email box here, which is blowing up, a lot of you like him too. So shoot an email to johnb@coasttocoastam.com and I'll get it to the good doctor. We will continue. This is Coast. Thanks, Ross. I really would like to stay here all night, but let me leave you with a little quote here before we take our final little two-minute break and enter our last segment with Dr. Tim Ball. When you see that trading is done, not by consent, but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors, when you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you, when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Ayn Rand, 1905-1982. Source, Atlas Shrugged. Well, we're not shrugging, are we? We're chugging. All the way to the end, bitter or sweet. It's up to us, isn't it? We'll be back with the last little segment with Dr. Tim Ball. 2 minutes, please. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Tim Ball, it is an absolute delight to have you with us tonight and be able to talk with you for most of 3 hours. about stuff that people are just not going to hear unless they are looking specifically for it. So thank you very much. And pick up where you left off.
Okay.
I can't remember where we were at this moment, but because we've covered so much.
We're talking about government and government control, and yes. You'd read the quote from Ayn Rand, which, of course, it shows that people are aware of these things. I think that there's a we'd also talked about water resources, and I was going to mention that the NAFTA, which, of course, a lot of people have talked about and criticized, and Ross Perot saying, you know, about jobs leaving the U.S., and he was so right on that. But it was about water resources, because we already have 80% free trade between Canada and the U.S., and so what was left to trade, and the negotiators on both sides were both experts in water resources, so that was what it was all about. And of course, the way it will be done is that water becomes a commodity, that is like gasoline as a unit price, and then once it's a commodity, it has to be part of the free trade agreement, and then also it will be it won't be shipped by tankers or anything like that, or diversion of rivers. It'll be done through pipelines, and pipelines, and maybe Obama should learn this, is part of the free trade agreement in the bulk carrier section. And I had done some research for a company that was looking at building water pipelines from Canada to the U.S., and of course Canada's got about 30% of the world's fresh water. But beyond all of that, I think that the and by the way, what's important about that, John, is we've talked about climate change and global warming, and all the focus is on the temperature, and all the focus on the warming. But the reality is, when you say to people, "What's wrong with warming?" For a lot of the world, warming is a good thing. And they're trying to make light of that now. But for Canada, for example, a 1 or 2 degree warming means our reduction of energy use and so on and so forth, and an increase of our frost-free season for food production and so on. The only thing that people can ultimately come up with is, oh, well, the ice is going to melt and the sea level is going to rise, which is why Al Gore made it such a big part of his Inconvenient Truth movie, which, by the way, again, you see, you've got to concede, was a superb piece of propaganda, but that's what it was. And I don't know if many of your listeners know this, but a UK court, a week before he got the Nobel Prize for that movie, ruled that it was political propaganda and had 9 major scientific errors. And they said if they were going to show it in the schools of England, it had to be with the warning about the errors and the political propaganda. But anyway, that's another story. But the focus only on warming. But now we're in a situation where the world is starting to cool down. And it's been cooling slowly but with increasing speed since 2000. And cooling periods are a much greater threat, but the world's preparing for warming. And it's completely illogical. But what's even more illogical is we know virtually nothing about precipitation. I mean, they don't even have enough weather stations to meet the statistical requirements for measurements of rainfall in Africa, the whole continent, that they can't even build computer models because they don't have the data. And yet, what do we hear from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? Oh, well, you know, there's going to be more droughts. Well, that's counterintuitive. If you get a warmer world, there's more evaporation, more moisture in the atmosphere. There should be less droughts, not more. But people are not talking about these things. I talk about them because when I talk with the farmers want to know, what's the precipitation going to do? They can tolerate temperature changes because they do it from year to year. But the precipitation is a much greater issue. And by the way, that's how I got into studying water resources, because after studying climate for a couple of years, I suddenly realized that the most devastating events are droughts for the plants and the animals and for human condition. I mean, you look at the droughts in the 30s and then the droughts of the 88, 89, where they had to reduce the barge traffic capacity in the Mississippi by 50% and all of these other things. But they're not even focusing on the precipitation because they don't have the data, but also because They don't want to talk about water or water resources because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, water vapor is by far the largest and most important greenhouse gas, and they simply don't want to look at it. But the precipitation patterns are of much greater concern, and cooling is of greater concern. I teased one group that I was talking to. They were shouting and yelling at me, and I said, "Well, look, we're preparing for warming, and it's cooling. You know, if the cooling occurs as we're expecting it to do, based upon sunspot activity, solar activity, that will be much, much cooler by the year 2015 and 20, and then right down to a cooler by 2035." Comparable to what we had in the last little ice age, then the only hope for adaptation, rapid adaptation, is genetic modification, because plant breeding won't bring you the plants quick enough in the 15 to 17 years it takes to get them online. So you might be forced to use that thing that you, the other thing that you so despise in technological advance. And so all of these issues around the climate debate that are simply ignored, are glossed over, and they can get away with it because, as I say, the public simply don't know about it or don't understand about it, and don't want to show their ignorance.
Dr. Ball, what's become of the hole in the ozone?
One of the things I get most frequently after I make a presentation is, I had my suspicions, I just didn't know enough to know.
What's become of the hole in the ozone layer?
Well, the hole in the ozone layer was always there. But it's not a hole. It's actually an area of thinning of the ozone. And even at its thinnest, it's still one-third the average depth of ozone around the planet. But the phrase ozone layer got out there. And, of course, it creates this idea that somehow there's this great big hole and all this nasty ultraviolet radiation is penetrating down. The ozone hole has increased and decreased with the changing patterns that create it and dissipate it, and it had nothing to do with CFCs. I appeared before the Canadian Parliamentary Committee on the Ozone and pointed out to them that ozone is created by ultraviolet radiation, but they started with the assumption that the ultraviolet radiation is constant, in the same way that they say effectively the sun's energy is constant when it isn't. And so if you assume ultraviolet radiation is constant, then you are forced to assume that if you're measuring variation in the ozone, oh, well, it must be something that humans are doing. Because we're always looking for, oh, there's those nasty humans on this planet. You know, we got to get them off the planet. They're doing nothing but harm.
Right.
Most people don't know, and we now, by the way, know that ultraviolet radiation varies considerably and explains most of the variation in levels of ozone. And so the ozone hole is another myth, in the same way, by the way, John, that the term greenhouse effect is simply completely inappropriate. The Earth's atmosphere does not work like a greenhouse, but it's become so much a part of our literature and so much a part of the PR and what's out there that the only way you can get around it is to explain to people, just as I've done with you with the so-called ozone hole, to explain to you why the Earth's atmosphere isn't a greenhouse and doesn't a greenhouse effect and doesn't work like a greenhouse at all. But the ozone issue, of course, was one of the early attempts to blame humans for destroying the atmosphere and causing all kinds of problems. And it's interesting that many of the people that were involved or that are now involved in the global warming issue and the IPCC were involved in the CFCs destroying the ozone issue. They cut their teeth on that issue, and they put forward the argument that the Montreal Protocol, oh, it stopped the use of CFCs and it's saving the ozone, didn't make any difference at all. And it was the same thing as with Kyoto. India and China, they said, oh, well, look, you created the CFCs, now you're telling us to have better refrigeration. Now you're telling us we can't have it, and we want to have refrigeration and save some of our food. Now you're telling us we can't have it. How about you lower your levels and let us increase our levels? We said no. They said fine. Then we're not going along with the Montreal Protocol. Now, this is what, by the way, Paul Dreesen has written so well about. It's what he calls eco-imperialism. We take our green and environmental eco-fanaticism and impose it on developing world. And of course, this is one of the most interesting things, because we started a lot of this conversation around the central theme of overpopulation. The world isn't overpopulated by any stretch of the imagination. We produce enough food every year to feed 26 billion people. The weaknesses are we cannot get that food to the table, all of it, or even a reasonable portion of it, and we don't have adequate storage. And the improvement of refrigeration took North America down to 30% of the food not making it to the table or being wasted. In the third world, it's still 60%. And of course, so we deal with the wrong issues all the time. But the other thing that's interesting is, and we've known this since the 1930s, when the economy improves, the population declines. It's called the demographic transition, and it's been happening in the developing world. You look at Japan, you look at France, you look at Canada. The populations are in decline because of the economic conditions, and so the best way to reduce the world population is to allow economic development. But of course, they're trying to stop that. And so you've got this irony. Now, in a lot of countries are offsetting the declining population with immigration. The United States is doing it. But Japan isn't allowing immigration. So what's happening? They've got an older and older population with an increasingly smaller, younger population that is not able to support the total social network government provision to their old people. And so Japan's either got to allow more immigrants or start facing some realities. That's an interesting part, by the way, John, with China. China dealt with the population issue by restricting families to one child. We worry about China taking over and its economic growth and everything else. And yeah, that's the case right now. The bigger problem is the Americans have borrowed too much money from them. But China's one child per family is going to have devastating effects on their economy starting to now. There are not enough girls for the men, and you just distorted the whole pattern so badly. That it's going to have huge impact, and and of course, by the way, it's another example of what happens when you let government run things. It doesn't work.
No, absolutely.
Yeah,
people, you can probably hear me clanging around in here. Actually, you got me thinking about the water, so I was banging around my stainless steel canteen here. I had a quick question for you, and that is this: when I was in pilot training in ground school, we had several weather books. And it's my understanding from those teachings that all weather, in fact, it was flatly stated that all weather is due to unequal heating of the Earth's surface. Have you found that to be true?
Yes, that's totally true.
Okay, excellent.
The best manual was, and I used it too, is called Weatherways. That was probably the one you used. And it was pretty universal across air forces in North America. But, and this is why, with the IPCC effectively ignoring changes in the sun and the energy coming to the Earth from the sun, for example, what's called Milankovitch effect, changes in the orbit of the Earth, changes in the tilt of the Earth, affecting the amount of solar energy. They don't even include that in their models.
Well, now this sounds like way out conspiracy theory stuff, but I understand that those contrails do occur up there in the stratosphere and at very high altitudes, but we see a lot of stuff being sprayed around here that, you see aircraft going by at the same altitudes, but they're not all leaving these trails, and before the end of the day, the entire sky is overcast, and it was not before.
Well, no, so, but think about it, though, John, because you see, the contrail, you can have an aircraft at any altitude is not necessarily going to produce a contrail. It depends upon the temperature and the water vapor content of the air and everything else as to whether a condensation trail is going to be created.
Well, then I've got to ask you this, Doc,
yeah.
And it's this. If you have two aircraft at the same altitude,
yeah.
One of them produces a contrail and the other one doesn't. What's up with that?
Well, that can happen. The air is so different, from one region to another. And if you want to find that out, even at the surface, and from flying, you watch that temperature and how the outside air temperature changes, and the wind patterns change with altitude. But you just drive a motorcycle out and across the air, and you feel how the temperature changes, within sections of land. So the variability of temperature and moisture conditions and everything else, it's just quite amazing. And of course, this is why it's laughable that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say, well, you only need one station every 1,200 kilometers to know what's going on with the temperature. Well, I mean, that's just crazy.
It sounds like the next thing for you, according to these emails that are coming in here, is people want you to do a documentary, grab an HD camera and make a documentary about this and get this information out to more people along with your books and your broadcasts.
Yeah, well, there is a very good documentary I did with Martin Durkin out of the Channel 4 in England called The Great Global Warming Swindle, and people might want to look at that. They can download it. If they want to find out how much we knew what corruption was going on in climate science, there was one made in 1991 called the Greenhouse Conspiracy.
What website could they get this at? Where would they go to get this information?
Well, they can get them on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Great Global Warming Swindle, or they can get both of them from a group that I helped set up called Friends of Science. That's all one word, friendsofscience.org, under their video listings. And also another website that I thoroughly recommend, it's the top in the world, is What's Up With That.
Okay.
It's spelled W-A-T-T-I-S, or What's Up, W-A-T-T-S-U-P. W-I-T-H-T-H-A-T. What's up with that?
What's up with that? Dr. Tim Ball, it's been a real pleasure. You must come back again sometime. It was very, very informative. I'll leave you with this, folks.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Take care, doctor. What would have happened if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive, or if during the periods of mass arrest, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, paling with terror at every bang on the downstairs door, and at every step on the staircase, but had understood they had nothing left to lose and boldly set up with a half dozen people and took care of business with whatever else was at hand. That's Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Maybe next Saturday at the usual undisclosable location, will you? Until then and beyond, be well. Good night.